Hey everyone, and welcome to the Image Doctors, part of the Nikonians podcast series. This is episode number 66 for May 15th, 2008. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And I feel like we're doing the news today.
I do too.
But nothing new to report here, so we'll give you our topics that we chose.
It'd probably be more interesting.
No current events to report today. What do we got on tap for today, Rick?
All right. Well, we've got several things. It's been a while since we've done one of the classic camera pieces, so we thought we'd do one on the F5, which is a camera both of us used for quite a few years, and that'll be fun. And then after that, we're going to talk a little bit about using some of the modern software, stuff that's just been put out in the last few years, with film scans. And so in a way, that kind of bridges back to the F5 topic a little bit. But we'll discuss some things that I've been playing around with recently, both in terms of image editing tools, noise reduction tools, all those sorts of things that you traditionally think about with digital cameras, but they work great with film scans
too. Sort of a back to the future kind of topic.
So we'll talk about that. And then after that,
we got a brief topic on using some auto correction tools. And for all you beginners out there who are swamped with a bunch of tools in Photoshop, Elements, or Capture NX, or whatever it might be that you're using to work with your images, a lot of these tools have auto correction options, and we'll talk about where you should use them, how you should use them, or why you should use them.
And when you shouldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, we'll have our prescription. So stay tuned for that at the end of the episode.
Yep.
Meanwhile, we'll talk about the Nikon F5, which was released in 1996. And I believe both of us have owned this camera.
I believe so.
So, and it was the first pro camera I had ever owned. And I remember just kind of drooling over the one that I got.
Yeah.
And that was late in the game.
Yeah. I had owned all the prior F cameras, and I still have them actually, just cause I can't get rid of things, I guess. But in the case of the older ones, I had bought all of those used because I didn't have a lot of money at the time I bought some of those. And it was getting them used was a great way to do it.
Well, you still don't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because it all goes into the camera stuff, right?
Yeah, that would be true. But the F5 was the first one that I bought brand new. And you were mentioning it came out in 96. I think I got mine in about 98, right around that time. So a couple years after it came out, but not too long. And I know both of us enjoyed using it quite a bit.
Yeah, I got mine actually in 2002 or 2003, so very late in the game. But what the first thing that tells you is just how long the product life cycles were for the F cameras, the Nikon's film cameras.
Different.
When I bought the F5... the biggest question I have is, do I buy that or the F100? But that's a different topic. But while the F100 was newer and it did have a couple of features that were kind of cool, there was nothing about the F5 that didn't scream top of the line Nikon. And this was several years, 6-7 years into its product life already. And so that's pretty amazing compared to what we go through now with, you know, 2-year life cycle, and people are screaming for why isn't there an update?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely different kind of philosophy these days.
So.
Not sure it's better.
In fact, one of the reasons why I didn't upgrade to digital until I did was because I wanted a digital camera that was built like the F5. Or at least better than the F5. I should say better than the F5. Because I knew that the D1 series was a more or less equivalent in build to the F5. I figured if I'm going to drop that much money on a new camera, it needs to be better than the one I already have.
Yeah.
So that was kind of interesting there too.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny talking about that. I think both of us like cameras that feel pretty solid, rugged, even if they're a little bit heavy. And at least I know that's my general preference. There are times I like the lightweight stuff, but for most of the stuff, I like the beefier things. And the first digital camera I got was the D100, and what I'd been using at that time was the F5. And
you must have hated that.
I kind of did, actually. I mean,
from an ergonomic feel perspective.
Yeah, I just never quite got on board with that camera. You know, the images it took were pretty good. I mean, and they're still good to work with, and you know, all that kind of stuff. But I just never really quite connected with it. It just never felt that great in my hands. You know, I didn't like the control setup all that much. And so for about the first at least 6 months that I had the camera, I really didn't use it much. You know, I did some snapshot kind of things with it and not much more than that. And the reason was I just loved that F5 so much. You know, it just felt great. And even on some pretty significant shoots in that first year that I had the D100, I didn't take it. You know, I took the F5 just because I preferred using it. And, you know, that all gets back to how nicely built it is and how well designed the camera was.
Yeah, well, that was the thing for me, too. I came into the F5 from the N70, mm-hmm. or for our European listeners, it's the same as an F70, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that was a plastic body, and it was a great little camera, very good for landscapes and easy to pack, and still felt, you know, it was still bigger than my old Nikon EL. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I got the F5 out of the box, and it was kind of like, oh, this is a real camera. Okay, yeah. This is a man's camera now.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I have a habit of doing is if I'm going to get something new, it's often just before, you know, some big trip or big shoot that I have planned, because it's just a fun thing to do, is be able to take it out there and use it. And I remember the first real excursion I went on was one up in the Pacific Northwest with the F5, and it was just fantastic. I'd been using the F4 before that, which was a very good camera, but the F5 had a certain kind of fluidity to it that the F4 just doesn't have, you know, and part of it was the much, much faster and better autofocus system. But I think it was also just the contouring of the camera. It just has a different feel in your hands than the F4 did, you know, which was, it was a pretty chunky camera.
That reminds me of when I bought my F5, when it showed up, I think I got it like on a Thursday or a Friday. I had it just long enough to charge the batteries, mm-hmm. and I hadn't done anything with it. And I had just moved to Colorado, so it was spring. And I woke up at something like 4 in the morning, and I drove all the way down from Colorado Springs to Alamosa, mm-hmm. to get there early enough to hopefully find some sandhill cranes and stuff. And I got there probably 7:38 in the morning after leaving the house at 4:30. I don't wake up very early. Not very many things motivate me to get up at that early, other than maybe a plane flight I've got to catch. Mm-hmm. And I hate doing it, but the F5 did. It motivated me to get my butt out of bed that early, mm-hmm. just because I wanted to see what this new camera can do. Mm-hmm. And I remember putting it on an 8 frames per second mode and almost going through an entire roll of 36 exposures and said, whoa,
yep.
This was too much fun.
Yeah.
But I guess back to what we were talking about when you were talking about the design, this was the first, the biggest thing, that the biggest difference of the F5 from its predecessors is that it wasn't a modular design. It was all in one, the integrated, mm-hmm. vertical grip, the big beefy, what we think of now as the typical pro camera look, mm-hmm. that a lot of manufacturers have. The F5 was one of the first Nikons to have that, mm-hmm. if not the first. And a lot of people didn't like that. A lot of people were kind of turned off by that whole gigantic
body. The idea that they couldn't strip it down to a smaller size if they want.
Right.
And, you know, there is some virtue to that. It's oftentimes a pro and con. It depends on the camera. With some of them that have the removable vertical grip, when it's attached, it just never feels that solid. It feels a little bit creaky and stuff. Now, you know, cameras like the F6 or the new D300 aren't like that. You know, when you put on their vertical grips, they feel, you know, pretty much rock solid. But some others, like my old D100, for example, which had an accessory grip, you put that thing on, it just felt kind of icky, in my opinion, by comparison.
Is that the technical term for it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It is. The F4 was pretty good with its grips.
Yeah, and there was a lot of people... Well, and there was a couple of unique things to the F5 that made people a little bit reluctant to adopt it at first. Another thing about the F5 was that it had command dials, mm-hmm. so it was, well, because it had command dials, it could use the new G lenses and such,
but, or control the older, you know, AFD ones.
Right, you could control aperture, mm-hmm. without the aperture ring. Mm-hmm. Some people who had F4s didn't like the fact that if you had to upgrade to an F5 to get that feature.
Yeah. And, you know, just to contrast things between the two cameras, with the F4, you still have the traditional shutter speed dial on top, kind of like you did with an F3.
Right.
Or an F2. And, you know, that's now on the back of the camera, like, you know, all the newer digital
just
ones.
The rear command dial.
Right.
And an LCD display that tells you what your shutter speed is.
Yeah. And whereas with the F4, you know, you use the aperture ring of the lens. On the F5, probably the most natural way to use it is with the sub-command dial on the front. Mm-hmm. There are ways of using the aperture ring, too, with it. But
the camera kind of was bulky to get in the way to use the aperture ring. Mm-hmm. You could do it, but it was a little easier, as far as I was concerned, to do everything with one hand.
So, that you know, that was a big thing for people.
But wasn't there a metering issue with some of the lenses that the F5 wouldn't meter with some of the earlier lenses unless you had it converted or something like or manual focus lenses? I can't remember. There was some issue with the F5 that made people critical of it as compared to the F4. AIS lenses or something.
Yeah, I think the thing that you're thinking about is matrix metering.
Oh, that's right.
Which it doesn't do with the older AIS or AI or AI lenses. All it supports is spot metering and center-weighted metering.
Okay. I knew there was some reason.
Whereas the F4 actually worked with all those modes with those lenses. So that was a little bit of a step back, and it upset some people.
But now, speaking of matrix metering... Mm-hmm. This was Nikon's most sophisticated implementation of matrix metering. And it was one of the reasons why I bought the F5 over the F100 was that it had, I think, 1,000-point matrix metering or
RGB
something like that.
RGB kind of metering.
And RGB. So it started to evaluate color data along with just luminance data.
Yeah, and it is an excellent meter. You know, if you're using slide film with it, it's remarkable how well it works. You know, I remember... getting just extremely consistent exposures if I was, you know, putting it in matrix mode.
And other things about the construction of this camera, the shutter was one of those heavy duty rated to 100,000 cycles or something like that. Mm-hmm. So definitely pro construction, solid metal chassis on the inside.
And one of the things, you know, I've still got mine, so I brought it with me today. You soldiers off, you know, heartless person that you are. But
that's because yours is now worth even less than what I got for mine.
That's all right. I like
something
it.
Had to pay for the D2X.
I still use it once in a while.
An awesome camera.
Yeah, one of the things that I find about it is when you pick it up, even compared to cameras like the D3, it still has a really solid feeling to it. There's just something about it where it feels like it's just hewn out of a solid block of steel or something.
Well, it's certainly heavy because it uses the couple options for batteries. The default was something like 8 AA batteries came in a tray.
Well, and let's see. Looks
now
like
you could save a little bit of weight by putting lithium batteries,
right? Which are what I have in here.
Which is or you could go with the rechargeable battery, which I had two of at one point, and those were great because they lasted. I think I could get easily 10 or 12 rolls of film out of one charge. And so two batteries in the field was plenty for me most of the time with what I was doing. But those were nickel metal hydride rechargeable. So they were a little heavier than the modern cameras now, which are all using lithium polymer rechargeable batteries. So that's one reason why the D2 and the D3 seem lighter. Mm-hmm. It's because they have lighter batteries.
Yeah. Now, you know... the autofocus system was improved.
Right.
You know, more sensors. The F4 just had a single one in the center. And this one, the F5s has a total of 5, which doesn't seem like many these days, but it was a nice improvement at the time.
And I believe the 3 in the middle were the cross-type sensors, and the 2 lateral side, the ones off to the left and right, were single lines.
I can't remember. Yeah.
Just trying to remember. I did a lot of homework before I bought the camera, so at one point I used to know this stuff.
I think I did too. Some other things that are worth mentioning is, like its predecessors in the, you know, professional F series, it has interchangeable viewfinders, which is something that hasn't carried over, at least so far, into the digital bodies. And, you know, probably one reason is they didn't sell in huge numbers. its big competitor at the time, just like is now the case, was Canon, and Canon had dropped its interchangeable viewfinders by the time it went into their autofocus series, you know, the EOS series. But there are some nice things about them. I actually brought a couple with me today, and we were playing with them earlier. One of them is the 6x high magnification viewfinder.
Or the let's look through the viewfinder and get ourselves seasick mode.
Yeah, because it reverses left to right.
It does.
But you see this, you know, absolutely huge image, which is great if you're doing macro work. It makes it very easy to focus in on fine details. And if you're using it, you don't need a right angle finder like, you know, the ones that we were talking about a few weeks back. Instead, you just use the finder because it comes up straight out of the camera and you look down into it. And it's got a diopter control so you can really dial in the clarity of the image, you know, for your own eyesight. So very nice thing for doing macro work. The only problem with it is when you used it, you lost the matrix metering and the center weighted metering and just had the spot metering mode, which is a little bit limited, but you know, you can make that work fine. Manual exposure. And then the other thing I brought just for fun was something I got, you know, very inexpensively. Never really used a heck of a lot, but it's kind of fun. It's the action finder.
Yeah, that's kind of fun.
Yeah, and Nikon, you know, made both of these finders for their earlier cameras too. So they were ones that had been around in some shape or form for a while. And the whole point of the action finder, which is this big bulky thing, even bigger than the regular viewfinder for the F5. The whole point is that you can have your eye very far away from the
several inches away.
Yeah, yeah, and so the concept is if you were, let's say, putting the camera into an underwater housing, you'd still be able to see the complete image as well as the exposure display. You know, if you were wearing a mask and all that kind of stuff. In some shooting situations where you might have to have eye protection on you, and again, you want to be able to see the whole viewfinder image. This works great for it.
This is I'm riding on the back of the motorcycle wearing a helmet with a visor, and I can still snap away viewfinder.
Right. So, you know, pretty cool thing. Yeah, so, you know, with the action finder, it's a cool thing, but like I said, I didn't really find too many occasions to use it. It's a pretty specialized thing, and you know, you'll know if you need one or not. Most people probably won't.
Well, and now I was just thinking about the action finder, and with the advent of live view, that effectively does the same thing.
Yeah, kind of similar, really.
Very similar. So you could use it, certainly, if you were going to put something like a D3 or a D300 into an underwater housing, which I might be reluctant to do, but if you were going to, at least you know you could shoot your camera in live mode and do that. So.
Yeah, sometime we're going to have to talk more about underwater stuff.
Just don't do a lot of underwater stuff.
Probably works best with point-and-shoots, I think.
But probably works best where there's somewhere where there's an ocean that you can get into, and Colorado doesn't have a lot of those.
No, last I looked, we didn't.
So it wouldn't happen if you're in a landlocked state.
Yeah. So other things on the F5?
Well, I mean, things that really struck my attention was that it would shoot at 8 frames a second if you used it would do that if you used the rechargeable batteries, I believe you had to.
And that's fast.
And that was very fast. That was what I used to call film waster mode. Just really fly through that. It had a quiet shutter release mode.
Which
was, I used it to play with it just to see what it did. It was somewhat quieter.
Yeah.
Few little things you could get them. I think a lot of times people would send them into the shop to get it modified so that it would leave the leader out on the film return, because normally it would pull the leader all the way in when you use the auto rewind. I think if you picked up an F5 today, for the most part, you'd be very, if you're used to using a Nikon camera, one of the current ones, you'd be right at home with an F5 in a matter of seconds.
You'd have no trouble using
it. The buttons are more or less in the same place where you would expect to find them.
They seem really dinky, though.
Yeah, they do seem kind of
little tiny buttons by comparison with today's ones.
Yeah.
And a few little irritating things, like to turn the camera on, you have to press a button down and then turn the...
Yeah, it had a lock on the switch on the top, which was a little frustrating. And of course, another nice thing about the camera was the integrated vertical grip, so you got a shutter release button when you were shooting in portrait orientation. Mm-hmm. I always thought that was kind of nice. Didn't think much of it before I got the camera until I go back to other cameras that don't have it, and I end up contorting my hand around.
Right.
So it is a lot more comfortable to shoot that way. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know about you, but one of the things I always end up doing when I think about some older cameras, especially if I still have them and I pull them out, is, you know, just things I did with them and cool places I went. And I think more than any reason, that's probably why I kept my F5. It triggers a lot of fun memories.
Mm-hmm. Well, and for me too, the first time that I really seriously used the F5 was the 4th AMPAT. Mm-hmm. And that's significant because the first time I actually met you in person. Yeah. So
that is momentous.
Look where it's gotten me. So that I went through a lot of film with that camera.
But, you know, some of the things I think about, I remember... I was working in Warsaw, Poland for a little while, and I took, this is my idea of a street camera. I had my F5 with, I think at the time, a 24 to 50 zoom and my 80 to 200 2.8. You know, and that's what I was lugging around the city, you know, shooting stuff with. And actually, it worked pretty decently. My shoulder kind of hurt at the end of the day.
I was going to say, that'll beat you up.
Yeah, but it was fun, and that was a fun experience working over there, too. It was an interesting place to be. And, you know, so that was fun. Did lots of cool wildlife shoots with it in places like Yellowstone and stuff like that. And, you know, certainly lots in Colorado. But
yeah. Oh, I guess another thing on one of those features that were there but didn't really use much on the F5, it had custom banks. It had two of them. And you could go through this little LCD menu and set up bank one or two or bank A or B, and you had some options for things, like if you wanted to reverse the direction of the command dials and things that are in the camera menus now on the digital cameras, like the D2 and D3, were in the F5. It was just very awkward to use. And one thing I remember having was that little cheat card that it came with that had the listing of the custom functions in case I needed to change something in the field. And I don't remember what all the custom functions were. But
I don't think I used too many of them.
But it was like changing the spot metering size and stuff like that. It was quite customizable, but not the easiest way to access. And that's something that I will say the advent of digital cameras and the F6, which has since replaced the F5, where it has the LCD screen on the back that at least gives you some information about your shooting, makes it a lot easier to use the camera.
Absolutely.
So the F5, I think in terms of longevity, is really, really amazing because it came out in 1996, and it wasn't replaced by the F6 until, when was that, 2004? 2000 and
something like that,
or maybe even later.
That sounds about right.
I think the F6 was announced right about the same time as the D2X was announced,
or
D2H,
yeah, whatever,
somewhere in there.
Yeah,
it was at a Photokina show or something. But when we talk about the F6 in some other episode, we'll go and do our homework better on that.
Yeah,
but it lasted a long, long time.
Well, and you know, talking about their usefulness today, I mean, like we were discussing, the camera is built, you know, to an extraordinary standard. So they just last and last and last. And especially if you get one that just had amateur use, boy, there's just a tremendous lifespan left in the camera. And they're, like a lot of film equipment right now, remarkably good buys. I mean, when I bought mine, 1998, it was $2,200. Ouch.
Yeah.
That was a lot of money at the time. And now you can buy them used easily in great condition for $500 or $600 in the U.S. That's just unbelievable. Makes me want to go get another one. I don't need one, but I think you need to buy one back. I think that's what you should do.
There you go. Well, maybe someday I will do that. But,
yeah.
I remember I bought mine as a refurb from Adorama, and it was a Nikon factory refurb, so it was a little bit less expensive at that point. But still, I remember going, whoa, that's a lot of money for a camera.
Yeah.
And I think I was able to sell mine for $800 with a little bit of arm twisting.
Yeah.
Because I had one that was essentially that amateur use. Mine was very pristine, not beat up at all. Well, I think it was a wonderful camera. Certainly, I have a lot of fond memories of it being the first pro camera that I ever had.
And sniff, sniff. Yeah.
It was great. Now, if you're going out and you're getting an F5 or any of these older film cameras and you're fooling around with it, well, then it means you're shooting film still. So our next topic, we're going to talk a little bit about using modern workflow and software, post-processing software, to work with your scanned film images.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about how this topic came up, because it was something that we thought up just a few weeks back. We were out in the Boston area doing some things, and just for fun.
For the day job.
Yeah, and just for fun, I'd brought a little rangefinder camera with me loaded up with film, and you know, doing some stuff there. And you know, when I got back,
just a little rangefinder, happened to be a Leica.
Okay. All right, so at any rate, that's what I was using. And you know, it is fun using manual exposure, really simple equipment at times, and Nikon has got some great stuff, you know, in that realm, including things that we've talked about in the past. You know, they're just, the stuff is very straightforward, simple to use, and in a lot of shooting situations, you don't need stuff like you find with a D3 or an F5 even. You know, it's amazing how much of the time.
Well, I had a camera,
simple
too.
Stuff works.
I had my iPhone. Yeah. I was using my phone camera.
Yeah, so that's true.
So then talk about going going a little bit primitive there.
Yeah. But bottom line, it's fun to do that at times. So I got back home, and for that specific shoot, I had, you know, just some color negative film in the camera. So I was doing film scans with, you know, my old Nikon 4000 cool scan thing. And, you know, one of the things I started thinking about is, you know, because I started working with the images, and, you know, if you're scanning color negative film, black and white negative film, the initial scans looked awfully, you know, will look awfully flat and dull, and
and a lot of times very grainy too with the film.
Very true.
Negative.
Yeah. And so that's what they look like just, you know, right out of the scanner. And I started, you know, just doing some things in Photoshop with them to clean them up. And then I started thinking, well, you know, I've got some other alternatives these days, you know, for working with scanned images. And there are a couple different routes you can go. We'll talk about them. What I did with the stuff that I had shot out there in the Boston area, and where we were actually out was around Rockport and places like that, was I imported those TIFFs that I had generated when I scanned them into Lightroom. And the nice thing about working with something like Lightroom or NX is another alternative, is you can do some non-destructive editing of the images, not actually get in there and modify the actual pixels, but, you know, just do tags and things like that in the images.
It looks like you're modifying the pixels, but
yeah,
it's saved as a non-destructive
right.
set of instructions.
But one of the really great things about it is the controls are a lot less obtuse than you find in Photoshop. You know, if you're wanting to adjust the color balance of the image, at least for me, I find it a lot easier to do it in tools like Lightroom or ACR or NX. It just, you know, more straightforward. The stuff is kind of grouped together, and it's very easy to do the other controls too, which get into things like setting the white points and the black points. And, you know, within X, you've got the option of doing the color control points, which can be a cool thing too.
That's right.
And all of these things work, you know, with scanned images. So it's just something to think about, because a lot of people get bogged down when doing film scans because they're using some of the other tools that are a little bit more difficult to get a handle on, yet because of things that they've been using recently, they feel pretty comfortable with doing raw conversions and, of course, you know, use the same things.
Right. I mean, the only difference between processing a a raw file in it and using a scanned slide is that you just don't get access to those raw only mm-hmm. kinds of controls. Like you can't really use the exposure slider and you can't adjust the tone curve. If you've scanned a Velvia slide, for example, the shadows that are blocked up are going to be blocked up. You're not going to be able to really recover that.
Right.
To some extent.
Yeah.
But the other stuff is still there. You can still add all the metadata tags, mm-hmm. keyword your slides, keyword those. I mean, that was for me. I've looking up on my shelf there. I've got about 20 1-inch 3-ring binders mm-hmm. full of pages of slides. And yeah, the binders have labels on the spine with more or less what the subjects were. And I wrote on each of the archive pages what it was. But man, unless you put a little dot or something on the slide and wrote stuff on each slide mount, forget it. And then with negatives, they're not even mounted. So mm-hmm. how do you do that? But if you scan them in, then you can get access to all that wonderful metadata side of the house, which allows you to browse things more easily, find the images that you want mm-hmm. and take advantage of that. It's a little bit more of a manual process because you don't have the shortcut of being able to have all that camera data imported right there with the EXIF information when you download the mm-hmm. image. Mm-hmm. So as far as getting camera information, if that's what you want, well, you got to still do that the old-fashioned way mm-hmm. and write it down. But as far as keywords and things go, you can still apply them. You just have to do it kind of on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be really clear, what I did with the images from that shoot, which were color negative, is I used, I think for those, I can't remember if I used Nikon Scan or ViewScan for those. Don't remember. They both work pretty decently for color negative stuff. And so what I did is I pulled them in, and then I actually did some initial things in Photoshop just to set the levels approximately mm-hmm. where they needed to be. And I also ran a noise reduction program on the images. Is if you haven't scanned color negatives or black and white negatives before, you might get a little bit shocked if you're coming from the world of digital capture where everything looks pretty clean, even at higher ISOs. With color negatives, they look pretty darn grainy.
They look like sand.
Yeah.
They really do. I mean, astonishingly so. You look at it the first time, if you're not used to it, you'll kind of jaw will drop and go,
my scanner's
broken. That's just awful.
Yeah, they can look that way. But fortunately, it's pretty easy to clean them up. And, we've talked about noise reduction tools in the past, things like Noise Ninja, Neat Image. You know, those tools actually started up as tools for film, you know, and just turned out, you know, they with some enhancements, worked really well for digital capture, too. I was using a thing called Noiseware, which is made by a company called, I think it's pronounced Imaginomics, and it's another very good noise reduction tool. But that's what I did for these images, and they cleaned up really nicely. They're not pristine, but the grain that you would see in the sky and other places like that was really reduced. So after I had that done, then that's when I pulled them into Lightroom and did further tweaking on the color balance and, you know, kind of fine-tuning contrast levels and all those other things. And did also sharpening, you know, a capture level sharpening of the image. And by the way, scan film needs it just like digital captures need it.
Right, because when you convert, there is an anti-aliasing step when the mm-hmm. when the scan comes through. Now, if you're using one of the Nikon film scanners, the cool scans, a lot of them have that digital ice, mm-hmm. which can help get rid of film grain
well.
And it works.
Well,
it works as advertised.
Yeah, there are a couple things there with the Nikon scanners, and they're analogous functions in Minolta and Canon ones. You know, that there's something for removing the dust and scratches, and by God, you want that turned on. With that off, it's amazing how
it sees nasty every little speck of dust.
Your images will
even
look.
The ones you don't notice.
Yeah, and you'll just take forever to clean it up, and that's even after you've blown off the images and maybe used a brush on them to get the big particles off. There's still a lot of crud on them. So you definitely want to have that on. And then the thing that helps with the noise or the grain reduction is a thing called GEM.
Mm-hmm. GEM.
Yeah, and just a little bit of that will definitely help too. I think the noise reduction tools like the one I was using are probably a little bit better in that they're pretty smart and they'll work selectively. They mm-hmm. know that you'll probably want to use more aggressive settings in areas that don't have a lot of detail like the sky. And then the areas where there is detail, they'll back off. And so that's a great thing, you know, with this kind of stuff. So that's what I was doing. Worked well. And just, you know, for some added stuff, I thought, well, all right, I need to do some black and white stuff as well. So I took the same camera, you know, that M7, and I went out and did some street shooting here in the general Colorado Springs area, specifically an adjacent little town called Manitou Springs. And it's just got some, you know, neat architecture and, you know, a little bit more of the small town feel. So my wife and I went out for a walk down there and did some shooting with Ilford XP2 chromogenic film. And it's a black and white film, but it uses the same process for processing as color print film, the C41 process. And so the nice thing about that is if you're not in a place where you can get convenient traditional black and white processing,
which is just about everywhere these
days. Yeah, it's getting harder and harder. So if you can't shoot Tri-X or something like that because of that, the Ilford XP2, and there's a Kodak equivalent of it as well, I think 400CN or something like that. Same basic idea, processed in C41 chemistry. You can take it to any place that does color print films and have them process it, and then I just scan that. Now, for that one, I know what I used in terms of the scan software, at least what worked the best, because I tried both. I think I've mentioned this in the past. The Nikon scan stuff just doesn't work well for this kind of film, and the ViewScan stuff works considerably better. Now, what you'll get when you first get the scanned images out is something that looks very flat, very lacking in contrast, and your histogram will look fairly narrow, and it will probably be bunched up a little bit toward the left. So you'll have to do a fairly significant levels adjustment on it. And I found that worked best doing that in Photoshop, saving the TIFF at that point, and then pulling it into something like NX or Lightroom. At least with the Lightroom controls, they don't work well when you've got that massive of change that you're making. They're better for more subtle things.
So you needed to use more of like a blunt mm-hmm. instrument.
Yeah. So, but same basic process, you know, same kind of mm-hmm. noise reduction software, everything. And it was a lot of fun.
Now, you mentioned non-destructive editing, mm-hmm. and this is a really good point about, because it's something that Lightroom does, it's something that Capture NX does, and that is, there's no reason, you know, we talk about RAW all the time, mm-hmm. but there's no reason not to use the same workflow, the same editing tools on JPEGs or TIFFs, whether those TIFFs came from your camera or the JPEG came from your camera or mm-hmm. if it was a scanned image. Mm-hmm. You can still create a non-destructive image or a non-destructive file mm-hmm. by editing your file in one of these programs. And for example, in Capture NX, you can use color control points and you can put in all the edit steps in the edit list. And unless you then save over the file as a TIFF or a JPEG, you can save a copy of the file in NEF format.
Mm-hmm.
And what that NEF format is it starts with the base image. The master image is the JPEG or the TIFF that you started with, mm-hmm. which is untouched. Mm-hmm. And then the instruction set of all of the edit list steps that you put in there, and so that you can go back and you can delete edit steps at a later time if you want to get rid of sharpening or something like mm-hmm. that. You can go through and you can do all this stuff. The only thing, like we mentioned before, the only thing you can't do is use some of the RAW only tools. Like you can't do the white balance adjustment in the same way that you would on a RAW file. There's ways you can tweak the
color
the
balance.
Color balance, but mm-hmm. you don't use the white balance presets like you would. Mm-hmm. And I think you can do the same thing in Lightroom and mm-hmm. I think probably Aperture as well.
Yeah, and you can edit those same images with ACR as well. You know, like in the case of the Lightroom thing, like I since that's what I was using for these images, it saves the edits in its database. Mm-hmm. And then, and you can just have all your images in there, you know, with the Lightroom edits sitting in the database. You know, when you browse them, they'll look like you want them to. And then if you want to do something with them external to the program, for example, if you're going to use Photoshop to print them or something like that, or you want to send off a JPEG of one of them to someone, then what you do is export them out. And mm-hmm. at that point, that's when those edits are burned into the image.
Yeah. At that point, then anything else you did would be mm-hmm. potentially destructive. But mm-hmm. but it's really good. It's really powerful. And it's something that shouldn't be overlooked.
Yeah. And chances are, like I mentioned earlier, you might find that it's a simpler way of working with your scanned film images. Or JPEGs or whatever you want to do.
Yeah. Just
they can be out of a digital camera, too.
You know, we talk about JPEGs like in some sort of, we badmouth them or something like that. But if you edit a JPEG and you save it in a format that is non-destructive, then you never overwritten the original JPEG data. Mm-hmm. So that becomes a very good master file if that's the way you want to do your workflow.
Now, while we don't find a lot of reasons to shoot with JPEGs because of the kind of stuff we like to do, for some people they're a great choice. And so this can be a really good way of working with them and editing them.
Well, and as the cameras get better and better at being able to produce a high-quality image out of the camera, it becomes a viable option mm-hmm. in some cases
just what you want. Anyway, something to think about if you have an old F5 or something like that sitting around. And by the way, you know, the street photography thing I was mentioning, that's a good break out of the doldrums kind of thing that you can do because you don't have to live in a huge city or one that's famous for having great cultural stuff. There are often interesting districts in almost any town, and you can go off and do some stuff. And, you know, you can even do dorky stuff. You know, take photos of stuff that's just plain dumb and silly. You know, we found some things when we were out there and we were doing shots like that. You know, not everything has to be serious.
Right. Maybe another episode we'll have kitschy photo episode.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so let's move on to the last topic on our plate for today, which is when to use auto correction tools. Mm-hmm. And this is a good topic if you're just getting started with
digital. It actually bridges well, by the way, mm-hmm. to what we were just talking about.
Right, because it might be something that would be very useful for one of your film scans.
Mm-hmm. And using those tools that we were discussing.
Right. So the most common auto correction tool that I can think of is the auto levels mm-hmm. adjustment. You know, it's that magic, you one-stop shopping, right? You push the button, boom, it did something. Sometimes your images look better. Sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
So what's it doing and why should you use it?
Yeah. And you know, this function, which you'll find in lots and lots of photographic software packages, varies from tool to tool as to what it's doing. Sometimes all it's doing is a simple auto levels thing like you were talking about, where it's automatically setting the black point and the white point and the mid-tone, you know, gamma stuff, you know, for brightness. Sometimes it's doing that stuff, plus it's doing color correction and, you know, trying to find things that it thinks are neutral toned and or should be neutral toned and making them that way. It just varies, and some are smarter than others. I don't use it a whole lot. I'm not a huge fan of it in general, although there are some times where I think it can be useful. The version of it that I don't care for in software packages is you press a button and it does something, and then it's not easy to override that. In other words, you don't see the control changes that it made to an image, and you're not able to go in there and manually tweak them.
Maybe undo it, than just click undo.
Yeah, that one I don't care for a whole lot. With programs where it's You know, like in NX, it's doing something with the levels curves function and adjust the sliders, and then you can go in there and tweak them. Ditto in Lightroom or ACR. That one is a lot more useful. You can kind of hit the autocorrect thing and then say, that worked, or that's not what I had in mind, but maybe if I just adjust the brightness level a little bit, it'll get it there. Those are more useful.
Yes, and sometimes you don't want to. One of the adjustments, like you were mentioning, is the trying to find neutral tones. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that works just fine.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is it's trying to get rid of unwanted color casts.
Mm-hmm.
But other times it ends up not working. And I'll give you an example. If you've shot, if you've taken a picture of something during the golden hour, and you've got that really nice warm light, well, that's a yellow color cast that's
right.
Pervasive through your entire image. The last thing you want to do is neutralize that and make it white.
Yeah.
It never looks good that way.
Right.
So there some of the tools will actually have ways where you can override that, and it'll just do the overall levels and curves adjustment, but it won't affect the neutral point.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can do that in Capture NX, like you were saying, by holding down the control key while clicking the auto contrast button.
Yep. And one little tip, if you are using NX, and I think you took this one and put it in your book, is go into the preferences and then adjust the clipping points. Make the black 0.05. I think it starts off as 0.5%. So make it 0.05% and make the white point 0.01%
instead of 0.1.
And what that means is it'll clip very little of the histogram on the black side or the white side, slightly more in the black. And I find it looks a lot better than the defaults. The defaults, in my opinion, produces images that look way too contrasty.
Yeah, they just look artificial, right. And somehow they're not right.
Yeah, yeah. So this is much more natural looking, so give that a try. Try the little trick about holding down the control key if you don't want it correcting the color cast. And, you know, when does this stuff work well and when doesn't it? What I find is that if I'm doing, you know, like a whole bunch of family snapshot kind of things, typical images of people and, you know, together and, you know, could be on a picnic or whatever, then this autocorrect kind of function works very, very well. I think it's kind of designed to work better for those kind of images. Where it often works atrociously would be on stuff like a landscape shot, interesting light, things like that. Just rarely works well. Now, you can always do the thing about adjusting stuff afterwards, but I just find it easier for those kind of shots just to do it all manually. In some respects, it kind of corresponds to, you know, when would you put the camera on program mode and shoot away, and when would you be more likely to go with manual? It's and use spot metering. It's kind of like analogous situations, I think.
These kinds of auto-correction tools tend to err on the side of boosting contrast.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just some images that don't look good when you boost the contrast, where you want the subtle tones, where you want to get detail. You don't want people's eye sockets turning dark.
Right.
But there's a lot of times where if you're using, especially in regular daylight conditions, where even with the tone correction on it, it just nails it pretty well and gives you something that's good enough for what you're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, in situations where you may be shooting, you know, a whole bunch of family shots and stuff, and let's say you've it really doesn't matter if you've done them in RAW or JPEG, you know, with some of the tools, like, you know, I was mentioning Lightroom, it's pretty easy just to select a whole bunch of images and have it auto-correct all of them. And you can always give it a shot and then see how it looks, and it's easy to reverse the effects of it if it didn't work well. So, you know, that may be a time to try it. And like with all stuff, you know, that we discussed, give it a try yourself. Find out when it's something you like using and, you know, when you'd prefer not to, but it's good to have it in your bag of tricks.
Yeah, and like we said in the previous segment, this is one of those things where if you can apply it and save it as a non-destructive edit step or instruction set, like in Lightroom or in Capture NX, that's good, because maybe in another year when you've learned to master some of the other controls, like the levels and curves tool, in a more fine-tuned kind of way, you're going to want to go in there and say, what was I thinking? And you'll delete that step and add back your own levels adjustment with custom settings that you can fine tune yourself.
Yeah. Now, one thing I'll point out, some software packages will have this feature enabled by default. For example, at least in the past, ACR was configured that way. And it would puzzle a lot of people when they would open up their images. They would have them, you know, shots that they bracketed, and they would all look the same because it was auto-correcting things so it looked the same. You know, unless you really want it that way, I'd probably start with it off and then decide when you want to have it applied. Anything else you can think of on that one?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. So let's move on to our photo prescription of the week. And this is one that you came up with recently.
It's a simple one.
That's what our prescriptions are hopefully supposed to be for.
Yeah.
And that's using hyperfocal distance in the combination of making large prints.
Right.
Which is something that's important because I think a hyperfocal distance, which we've talked about before, is the concept of it is that it's supposed to be, you set a particular f-stop and you set a certain focus point on your lens and everything from wherever to infinity is in focus.
Mm-hmm. And that wherever varies with the aperture. You know, the smaller apertures like 11, 16, 22
right. And the focal
will have length. A closer point. Yeah, and the focal length of the lens will affect it too. Wide angle lenses will have, you know, more a broader range of depth of field, you know, for a given focus point.
So if the hyperfocal distance does that and everything's in focus, why should it matter what your print size is?
Okay. So here's the thing is that everything really isn't in focus. You know, that's something that a lot of people think. It's not really true. There's still, even if you stop down, there's still one plane of focus in the image, one distance that's truly sharp. It's just that as you stop down more, the areas that aren't as sharp are less unsharp.
They appear to be in focus.
Yeah, they appear to be in focus. And if you have a smaller sized print, that helps stuff look a little bit sharper. You know, as you get a bigger print, it will look more unsharp. And the other thing that can vary is the viewing distance. So if you're farther away from an image, you know, picture a billboard that's half a mile away, it might look fine, even though you used a pretty conservative aperture. But if you were to get right up close to it, you might notice that, you know, things were not as crisp as you thought, you know, from a distance.
Well, it's the classic, I zoom in to 100% view and things aren't as sharp anymore. Right. What's the deal? Yeah. Well, that 100% view does not really correspond to the way you're viewing the image.
Right. So when you look at tables or, you know, little software tools that help you calculate the hyperfocal distance, usually those are based off of making an 8x10 print, 8x10 inches. And, you know, today that's not that big anymore. You know, it used to be kind of a big enlargement, but especially with digital cameras and people having printers at home that will do 13x19 inch prints pretty easily, a lot of people are making the bigger print sizes. And that's where the formulas that you see in a lot of the tables fall apart, as they were intended for smaller size prints. So here's the easy tip. If you're making something like a 13x19, look up the hyperfocal distance for an aperture that's one size larger.
One F number smaller, but...
So give you an example. And if you shot at F11, instead of looking up F11 in a table, look up F8 and use the hyperfocal distance for F8. And that'll just get you a little bit sharper print at that bigger print size.
Okay. Well,
simple thing, but it turns out about right mathematically.
Absolutely. So that's our show for this week. Don't forget, we're still looking for more ideas for show topics. We haven't forgotten about you. We are getting a steady stream of them.
Mm-hmm.
We have to go through and compile everything, but we are listening.
We do have a list.
We do have a list. And so if you've got a show topic idea or a prescription idea or any kind of idea, or you just want us to read your name on the air, send us an email to talkradio nikonians.org, and we will gladly respond to your email. And don't forget to vote for our podcast on Podcast Alley.
Yep.
Because we like that, and it helps us promote the podcast. I mean, everybody should listen to this show, right?
I think so.
At least if they're a masochist.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll see you guys in another 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
All right, bye-bye.